Hello there. It's KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Ross Reynolds in for Bill Radke. Our panelists this week, Essex Porter. He covers government and politics for Cairo TV. Chris Vance, former member of the Washington State Legislature, former chair of the Washington State Republican Party, and Erica C. Barnett, an independent journalist who blogs at C is for Crank. Great having you all here. Thanks for taking the time.
Good to be here.
This week, under pressure from President Trump and some fans, the National Football League owners ruled that players could no longer kneel during the national anthem. And if they do, they could face punishment or their teams could be fined. The NFL says athletes who don't want to stand for the anthem have the option of staying in the locker room for the pregame ceremony. The Seahawks weighed in on the league's new policy, protesting the national anthem. Here's quarterback Russell Wilson.
I think we're focusing on the wrong things. You know, there's so many things. You know, no policy is going to fix our problems that we have in America right now. It's not going to fix, you know, all the shootings that are happening. It's not going to fix all the racial tension. You know, some policy, you know, for the national anthem. I think we're getting distracted a little bit about what that means.
Seahawks coach Pete Carroll said the new national anthem policy, "We've always stood for our players to have the opportunity to speak for themselves and be advocates of free speech and the democracy that we love and the freedoms that we love. And we're going to continue to do that," end quote. Continue to do that. I hear some defiance in that quote from Coach Carroll. Do you think the teams and the players are going to comply with this move to squelch the national anthem protests? Erica?
Well, you're turning to the least NFL savvy person here to know what the NFL players are actually going to do. But I certainly hope that they will, because, you know, going into the locker room and hanging out there off the field is the opposite of protest. And if that's what happens, I mean, it really will be an example of their opinions being squelched, their First Amendment rights to protest being squelched. The point of protest is to disrupt. And being out on the field and kneeling is disruptive by design. And so that is an exercise of their First Amendment rights. I believe that they have the right to do that. And I certainly hope that they will continue to do so, because to do anything else is not to protest.
They have the right to do that. But this is their workplace and they're representing these teams, and the teams and the league have the authority to regulate what happens, you know, in their workplace and how they sell their product to the public. This is all so ridiculously unfortunate. And what bothers me the most is that the president has chosen, he didn't start this. Colin Kaepernick started it, but he has chosen to weigh in and turn it into a political issue to further divide this country. And this is not public policy. We're not talking here about bringing down the debt or fixing health care or anything else. It's culture and it's race. And that's what everything has become in this country under the guise of politics. And it's terrible. It's divisive.
I just wonder what Coach Carroll means when he says, "We've always stood for the opportunity of players to speak for themselves and be advocates of free speech, and will continue to do that in the face of this policy," which clearly is telling players they're going to be fined, the teams are going to be fined. What do you think about this, Essex?
Well, I don't think Coach Carroll is Coach Carroll's sort of saying the obvious there. I don't think he's necessarily rallying the troops to do some visibly defiant thing. As you will recall, as the Seahawks address this, it was Coach Carroll who really tried to rally the team to act together, which meant that, you know, the protest was not, you know, all of the Seahawks kneeling. So I think Coach Carroll is saying something to acknowledge what's there, but I don't think he's promising anything. I think one of the real problems that the NFL has, and you didn't play a comment, any comments from Doug Baldwin.
Oh, I'm going to.
But
would you like to hear one?
Yes.
All right. Well, President Trump, as you know, has praised the NFL owners for doing what he called the right thing and requiring the players to stand during the national anthem. And he also suggested that people who don't stand for the anthem maybe shouldn't be in the country. And here's what Seahawk wide receiver Doug Baldwin had to say.
He's an idiot. It's plain and simple.
And he went on to say this.
He's just being more divisive, which is not surprising. It is what it is. But for him to say that anybody who doesn't follow his viewpoints or his constituents' viewpoints, you know, should be kicked out of the country, it's not very empathetic. It's not very American-like, actually, to me. It's not very patriotic. It's not what this country was founded upon. So it's kind of ironic to me that the President of the United States is contradicting what our country is really built on.
Essex?
Well, and I would take you beyond those particular Doug Baldwin comments.
Yes.
Because Doug Baldwin also talked about how he reminded us that the NFL owners and the teams and the players were working together. But that when they come up with this policy, the teams, the NFL, the league comes out with a policy, no consultation with the NFL Players Union or the players on what they were working together to help build communities. So they feel also betrayed by their own league.
That's why I wonder if it's going to stick. Erica?
I just want to respond to a couple things that Chris said about it not being public policy. I would say police brutality actually is public policy. Mm-hmm. And what they're protesting is the public policy of endemic police brutality across the country and the fact that Donald Trump does not care about it and the fact that nothing has been done about it. And, you know, police shootings are continuing as this protest is going on and as the protest over the protest is going on. I don't remember the exact numbers from this year, but I mean, this is a public policy problem. And the notion that it's their job and therefore they can't protest because they're being paid to be there. I mean, would you say that about, you know, people who are violating transportation rules by, you know, by protesting on highways? I mean,
yes.
So you would say that about the Selma to Montgomery march?
No, I think they had a permit, if I remember correctly. But you can't.
I don't think that the civil rights movement was based on the notion that we will only protest if we have a permit.
The First Amendment doesn't mean you can protest anywhere, anytime, in any way you want.
But the nature of protest, again, is to be disruptive and to break rules. And so if you're saying that protest is only acceptable if it's rule-abiding, then it's not really protest at all.
And of course, if you want to do that, you are risk the chance of going to jail, and these teams risk the chance of being fined. And look, I want to
move on to that point, because is there any sense that this is going to settle it, or will some teams run the risk of being fined? Will there be more protests of this particular policy?
Donald Trump doesn't want it to be settled. He enjoys this. It stirs up his base, which is his whole electoral strategy. He will keep it going if no one else. And I want to say Doug Baldwin is 1,000% right. In every word he said, and he's a far better American than Donald Trump is.
And I think one of the things that some of the players have raised and others have raised is, you know, why do the players have to somehow be more respectful during the national anthem than the fans do? They don't close the concession stands during the national anthem. People are up there buying beer while people are singing the national anthem. Why is it that the fans don't have to be at least as respectful as the players?
Because the players are wearing the uniform of their employer. And look, I totally understand why the players are doing this, and I find it's uncomfortable to have to defend this practice. But the NFL has a right to regulate its product.
Are you calling the players a product that the NFL owns?
The game is a product that the NFL owns. Of course it is. And how it's portrayed to the, you know, the players aren't allowed to wear anything they want. They can't wear, it's down to regulating their socks and that sort of thing.
The WNBA wore Black Lives Matter t-shirts and they were fined, and then the WNBA walked that back and said that they were wrong.
And we'll see, because
I
think you're right. This is not the end of it. So there's going to be some kind of other move from the players, maybe from the coaches, maybe from the owners, and we'll see how this...
And by the way, this is a very simple way to solve this. Before 9/11, NFL teams stayed in the locker room, did not come out for the national anthem. College football teams stay in the locker room, come out after the national anthem. That's what the league should have done. That would have ended it.
Not even have the players on the field during the national anthem.
That's what they do in college football, and that's what they used to do in pro football.
But then they will not have a chance to show their protest if they have to stay in the locker room.
They have the rest of the time to show their protest, other than when they're representing the Seattle Seahawks.
I mean, I'm not sure if I agree with what the league owners are doing, but there are restricted political rights within the workplace, aren't there?
Well, and lots of, I mean, you see protest of those restrictions in other arenas too. You see NFL cheerleaders protesting the fact that they're required to behave a certain way in, you know, under very sexist rules that dictate how they can act in their private lives. I mean, there is a whole discussion we can have about how much these team owners and other people, you know, in control here are restricting how much people are able to act. And I would say that, you know, that the NFL is right to push back on that.
You know, we've been talking about the politics of this, but isn't this a straight up business decision by the NFL? Are they calculating that maybe you don't notice it in Seattle, but writ large, the fans of NFL are upset about this and they're going to do something about it to address it. What do you think about this, Essex? Is there just an economic incentive to impose this new rule?
Well, there's always an economic incentive to duck controversy. But, you know, it is also the NFL that has wrapped itself in the potential controversy by the way it embraces patriotic and military themes. No, you know, no one says you have to have a military color guard begin a football game. That's the NFL embracing those themes and trying to tap into that. So, you know, with that comes the controversy.
Essex Porter from Cairo, Chris Vance here, former head of the Republican Party, Erica C. Barnett, who blogs at C is for Crank. We're going to take a short break and return and talk about the continuing controversy of the head tax. One more note on the NFL owners' attempt to squelch protests around the national anthem. The CEO of the New York Jets, Christopher Johnson, says, if someone on the Jets takes a knee, that fine will be borne by the organization, by me, not the players. He says, I never want to put restrictions on the speech of our players. Do I prefer that they stand? Of course. But I understand that they felt the need to protest. So, Paul Allen, what do you got to say about this? Give us a call or tweet at us. You're listening to KUOW, The Week in Review, and we have with us Essex Porter, Erica C. Barnett, and Chris Vance. Still in the news this week, big time, is the head tax. Seattle's major employers, Amazon and Starbucks, have each kicked in $25,000 in the effort to overturn that controversial head tax imposed on them by the city council. Now, it passed on a 9-0 vote, money from the head tax tagged to go for low-income housing and emergency services for homeless people. This was a lower tax than initially proposed, designed perhaps to placate Amazon and other employers with a more palatable tax. But how has this compromise worked out? Has Mayor Durkan basically failed on this in attempting to come to a compromise? And now she's got the people she may have been trying to compromise with funding an effort to overturn this tax. Chris?
Yes. Yes, they've lost control of this issue. And what's fascinating about this to me is, you know, I spent 8 years on the King County Council. And the county council was Republicans and Democrats, suburban versus Seattle. There's always two sides. The Seattle City Council, although they have their moments, it's always been, we all agree, we're all liberal Democrats. There aren't two parties. This issue is splitting Seattle in a fundamental way. You're seeing the emergence of basically two parties in Seattle. I don't know what the names of these parties are going to be eventually. Not Republican. There are no Republicans left in Seattle. But you're seeing a sharp division between the Stranger and the Seattle Times, between some unions and other unions, between the business community and the council, between old line Democrats who are liberal versus the socialist alternative folks. And these battle lines are hardening, and you're going to see it play out during this initiative, and you're going to see it play out next year when all seven council elected city council candidates are on the ballot.
Essex, is this a fail for Jenny Durkan? She tried to thread the needle here, it sounds like, and with the people she was trying to make come along with her, like Amazon, now they're funding an effort to overturn this.
Yeah. Well, you know, she did succeed partially. Amazon did withdraw its hold on roughly 500 jobs. So to that degree, it was a success. She also succeeded in getting what she wanted in terms of a time limit on the tax. Because it originally did not have a 5-year expiration, and she wanted an expiration, and she got that. But you know, overall and politically, the issue is so divisive that no, she wasn't able to bring the entire city together. She was able to bring the council together in a compromise. But, you know, the problem predates her becoming mayor, because the fact that Seattle has not been able to keep up with a fast-growing homeless population and move people off the streets into safe and permanent housing, so that it is now so visible. It's been such a rapidly growing problem that she, as mayor, certainly could not keep up with it, being in office really just, you know, hardly less than a year.
Well, I want to pursue that, because I think people who are pushing for a rollback of the tax are going to say that the money's not being used well. We've already heard them say that. They say affordability and homelessness programs are not working. Home prices and affordability continue to go in the wrong direction despite all the spending. Erica C. Barnett, is that claim valid?
Well, I want to first answer your first question about Mayor Durkan, because I wrote a whole piece about that, which is, did she fail? And I would say the answer is she made a rookie mistake and got outplayed by Amazon.
So she failed.
Well, yeah, and I think that it, you know, just a quick contrast to $15 an hour, which was incredibly divisive, and which the former mayor, disgraced ex-mayor Ed Murray, did get some of the same players that are now protesting and spending money to kill this head tax on board with the $15 an hour compromise. And I think it shows the difference between a weekend of talking to Amazon and then negotiating with the council, and months and months of negotiating with business and labor and bringing everybody on board. So is the homelessness problem getting worse? Yes, obviously it is. I think that that might be an indictment somewhat of the strategies that we have been using to address the homelessness crisis, namely the fact that we're not providing actual housing. And the problem of homelessness is also a problem of lack of affordable housing. Our focus in the city has been on emergency shelter. Mayor Durkan's proposal actually would have doubled down on that focus. And we don't have housing. And so it's, you know, it's a problem of Amazon driving up housing prices, but it's also a problem of, you know, we're just not allowing housing and we're not spending money on housing. So there's a pipeline that goes into a funnel that, you know, that there's no housing at the end of.
And Erica, when you say allowing housing, I think you mean beyond building specific affordable housing for people who are homeless.
I mean beyond that, yes. I mean both. We don't have, I mean, we have 60% of the city's residential land zoned just for single family use. So we have this massive amount of land where we can't even build housing. And so, yeah, I think that that's a problem when we have 115,000 people moving here in a year. Those folks are competing for the same housing that, you know, that I am and that low income people are. And it just, if you don't have the housing, you're not going to solve the housing crisis.
And how does this play out with the public? Should this get on the ballot? Should there be an attempt to repeal this head tax? Is the public going to not react with empathy and understanding towards the goals of increasing affordability and reducing homelessness, but rather react to what they see as the ineffectiveness of city government in accomplishing
those goals? To find out. I mean, I would predict that the referendum is going to get on the ballot. If you have enough money, you can always buy the signatures. And again, there's going to be city council elections next year. The voters are the ultimate arbiters in a democracy, and we're about to find out how far left the voters of Seattle are comfortable going. There's a growing sense that the Seattle City Council has gone too far, not just on the head tax, but first on the minimum wage and then on other tax increases, on how they're dealing with the homelessness issue. Others disagree, saying they haven't gone left enough. But this dispute, which has been sort of below the surface, has now burst out, and it's actually driving politics statewide. The Republicans are going to use this in their legislative elections, and the idea of crazy Seattle politics is becoming the political issue.
Chris, I want you to set aside your political beliefs for a moment and put on your political consultant hat.
Mm-hmm.
And you are running the campaign against overturning the head tax. What's your strategy?
Demonize those who are funding it, say this is evil, corporate greed. And what are, if not this, what are we going to do to help our disadvantaged neighbors? But the first thing you do is, which campaign am I running?
You're running the campaign to keep the head tax
right.
from being thrown
That's
out.
Right. So
yes,
the first
yes.
thing is you demonize those who are funding the campaign. That's what they will do. And that probably is what polling shows would work.
And Essex, what do you think the successful campaign against overturning the head tax would be? How would it be formulated? How do you appeal to voters who appear to be becoming very skeptical about how the money's being spent?
You need to show voters that some of the money has been used effectively. The report done by the folks at McKinsey and Company really did not criticize so much the way whether money was used effectively. It said that really there wasn't nearly enough money to keep up with a rapidly, rapidly growing problem. So find the success stories and highlight those. Highlight things such as the growing success, still not nearly enough, but the growing success of the city's navigations teams in moving some people off the street and into safe and permanent housing. By the time this campaign comes around in November, some of the city's realignment of the way it approaches the homelessness problem will have been online for nearly a year. If there are success stories there, highlight that. Try to build some trust and some record of accomplishment while acknowledging it is not perfect and more needs to be done better.
Eric, I'd like you to go through the same exercise. Stepping back from what you believe is to be true, if you were running the campaign to repeal the head tax, how would you run that? How would you appeal to citizens?
Well, I actually agree with both Chris and Essex to an extent. I think you have to point to success stories, and there are success stories, even though, you know, my personal belief is they need to spend more on housing and less on shelter and emphasize that. And I also think that, you know, not necessarily demonizing Amazon, but pointing out that the people who are, and I don't think they're going to have to buy signatures. I think people are eagerly jumping up and getting signatures. And I think it's, you know, to use a Marxist term, it's a little bit of false consciousness. It's people who are homeowners and taxpayers saying this is bad because it's going to somehow impact us. And I think that, you know, quote unquote, demonizing a company like Amazon would be to point out that Amazon has not shown any good faith and has not shown that it actually is invested in Seattle. I mean, they're threatening to pull out another 130 jobs to send them to Phoenix. And so I think that there needs to be a dissociation of individual interests, like my interest as a, you know, as a taxpayer in, you know, whether Amazon has to pay this tax, because it's not a property tax on me or anybody else who, you know, is out there railing against the head tax. It's a tax on Amazon, and it's a tax on companies making over $20 million a year. Mm-hmm. So I think that that's a tough thread, a tough needle to thread, because people are just sort of in a reflexively anti-tax mood now because they see the tents on the street and they feel that nothing's getting done. But
what's fascinating about this is the Seattle way is let's all sit down together and reason together and go through a ton of process stuff. And I don't think people of Seattle are used to this. This is how politics is practiced in most of the rest of America. No, we don't agree with you, period. And let's fight it out. We're going to have an election and we're going to run a campaign and we're going to duke it out and we're going to see who wins.
I would actually say referendums are much more common here than they are in most of the rest of America by design.
That's where we're headed. I think this referendum campaign is going to be a brawl, and next year's city council elections are going to be epic.
Well, some people might see a bright side to the head tax. It costs about $275 per employee. Pierce County Executive Bruce Dammeyer says they're considering a $275 tax credit to companies for each new family wage job they create.
$275 is a good number. I think it highlights some of the contrast that people need to know that Seattle doesn't speak for Pierce County and Pierce County doesn't speak for Seattle.
$275, a good number, he says. Can Pierce County expect to lure the Seattle businesses by offering a tax credit for each new employee equivalent to the tax fee being suggested by Seattle government? What do you think, Essex?
Well, there may be some. Leading economist I talked with, Matthew Gardner, says that tech companies actually tend to like to group together. They like to be in the same place. You know, Facebook and Google move here because there's a talent pool here that they get from Microsoft and Amazon. So whether a tech company would move to Pierce County or Tacoma, he thinks that's unlikely. But, you know, other companies like manufacturing might decide to do it, depending on whether it would, you know, pencil out for them leasing land or constructing a building. You know, it's not just the tax credit. But the one thing I noticed is the mayor of Tacoma she was on the bandwagon, but she was really clear that she was not adding the $275 a head tax credit to Tacoma. She says they already have $1,500 in tax credits that you can get in Tacoma for bringing jobs there. So I'm curious, if there's already a $1,500 credit in Tacoma, how is that working out?
This isn't about economic development. This is about politics. Bruce Dammeyer has no realistic expectation this is going to draw any new companies to Pierce County. That's not what he's interested in. He's interested in being governor. That's what he's interested in. And what you saw all over the state is suburban officials and other officials saying, come move your business here, not thinking anybody would, but just to immediately say, we are not like those crazy people in mm-hmm. Seattle. You know, one of the things I'm working on now is trying to build a new centrist movement and recruiting candidates to run for the legislature. and more independents than ever have filed for the legislature. And what we're hearing is, yeah, a lot of moderate Republicans saying, boy, Donald Trump's crazy. We need to find something else. And a lot of moderate Democrats saying, the Seattle City Council's crazy. We need to find something else.
Bruce Dammeyer, clever political move or just a posturing? What do you think, Erica?
I mean, I think it's a political move that isn't terribly clever. I think it's the sort of thing that Pierce County in particular likes to do. I mean, it's a much more conservative area than Seattle. I do think, two things. Amazon's average wage is not what you would call a quote-unquote family wage job. And so if they're talking about, we'll just take all the tech jobs and Amazon or whoever can come here, well, I mean, they're going to also take the consequences. And one of the stories that I read about this, I think in the Seattle Times, noted that people are starting to get concerned about housing prices in Tacoma going up. And as I said before, one of the reasons that housing prices have gone up so astronomically here and are up above $800,000 for a single family house now is because of Amazon's influx of people, you know, being incredibly well paid and able to pay for those higher housing costs. So does Tacoma really want $8,000 median house? I don't presume to speak for them, but I think not. And so, you have to take the good with the bad.
More thoughts on the Week in Review from Erica Essex and Chris coming up in a moment. I'm Ross Reynolds in for Bill Radke. It's KUOW, Sound Stories, Sound Voices. It's Week in Review. Thanks for joining us. I'm Ross Reynolds in for Bill Radke. Our panelists, Essex Porter, you see him on Cairo TV, Chris Vance, political consultant, former member of the Washington State Legislature, Erica C. Barnett. You can see her blogging at C is for Crank. President Trump this week called off a June summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un.
Based on the recent statement of North Korea, I have decided to terminate the planned summit in Singapore on June 12th.
But that was yesterday. Here's what the president had to say today.
It could even be the 12th. We're talking to them now. They very much want to do it. We'd like to do it. We're going to see what happens.
My head is spinning. Will these commemorative medallions with Trump and Kim ever get put to good use? What do you think? Silence.
I think that, as the North Korean expert on this panel, obviously, I think this summit was never going to happen. And I think that this is what everyone with sort of any expertise in this area expected was going to happen, that it would end up getting called off. And I think it was a political stunt on both their parts. I think now Trump has an excuse to say, to go to war or sort of make bellicose gestures toward war. And Kim has an excuse to say, the U.S. never wanted to bargain in good faith in the first place.
It has long been North Korea's ambition to break off the South Koreans from the United States. And there's some evidence that a lot of this has been driven by the overly hopeful attitudes of the new South Korean regime. The new president of South Korea ran on a platform of let's work with the North. We don't need these Americans. But I mean, what we're ultimately talking about here is the only thing that's worth discussing is whether or not North Korea will completely give up their nuclear weapons. They've said over and over again they will not. And so what are we going to give them in exchange? What they want is to us withdraw American troops, stop doing joint exercises with South Korean forces, and we're never going to do that. So this is probably never going to happen, and if it did, it would probably be a disaster. But this is a problem of – this president seems to think that foreign policy is the same as negotiating with Russian oligarchs over property in Florida, a.k.a. money laundering, and it's not. This is for grown-ups and smart people, and he's completely out of his depth.
Essex, cash in with your commemorative Trump Kim medallion right away, or what do you think?
I was trying to get one yesterday because they were on sale yesterday, and the website was frozen. I couldn't buy it. So if you have it, keep it. I think it's going to be valuable. Whether there's going to be a summit or not, I don't know whether really to be more worried or more relieved. It does not appear really that there's going to be a summit anytime soon. And to me, it appears that North Korea has gotten very much of what it wanted. It wanted to have a nuclear deterrent to the United States, which it now has. It wanted the United States to treat it as an equal, which President Trump is now doing. I'm not so sure the North Koreans have that much more on their list.
But what I thought was interesting that Trump's cancellation just came hours after the North Koreans, in a big show with a lot of journalists there, said destroyed their nuclear testing facility. However, there were no independent weapons analysts there to observe to find out what actually happened. But it was certainly something that suggested that they were sincere about doing something. Is there any belief that that actually happened? Was that just a show on their part?
Well, I'm not a technician, right. But you can only test nuclear weapons at a site a certain number of times until it's ruined. And that's most people believe that's what had happened there. But earlier, when Bolton put out a statement comparing the North Koreans' future to that of Libya, the North Koreans immediately said, hell no. I mean, we're not going to be Libya, meaning we're not going to give up our nuclear weapons. If North Korea is not going to give up their nuclear weapons, what is the point of any of this?
Right. And Libya means give up your nuclear weapons, and then 10 years later, your leader will be dragged through the streets and stabbed to death, which I don't think Kim Jong-un wants. Anything else to say about this North Korea situation? I think it's so crazy when you've got two leaders who are bobbing and weaving and flipping and flopping, and the idea of them getting together, just what can happen out of that? It's crazy.
Josh Marshall wrote a really interesting piece about this, which focuses on the fact that Trump, and probably Kim as well, but particularly Trump, sort of quote-unquote negotiates everything and makes decisions on such personal terms. And he thinks of everything in terms of personal insults and personal deal-making.
That's right. It was comments about Pence being a dummy that kind of led to his cancel part.
Yeah. And so I think that speaks to, you know, the fact that we're dealing with sort of two erratic, authoritarian leaning in one case and actually authoritarian in the other, leaders who take everything really personally. And it's just a testament to the fact that there's really no predicting what Trump will do, except that when he feels personally insulted, he will lash out in a personal way. And if you look at his letter, I mean, it uses all these terms. And Marshall does this analysis of, like, you know, sad, beautiful, terrific, tremendous, you know, all of Trump's sort of favorite terms to describe, the loss that he feels at losing this victory, you know, that he perceived of the summit, and just how personally he took it. That is a terrifying thing.
When do the apparent failures of the Trump administration finally catch up to it? I mean, we don't have a wall. We haven't thrown Hillary in jail. It looks like this summit is highly unlikely. We can go down a long list of things that were going to be done, but they never seem to quite catch up to the president.
Well, nothing is going to shake his base. Nothing. There is nothing that will shake his base, because no matter what he does, no matter what he says, no matter what happens, no matter how badly things turn out, when you push them on this, they say, well, at least he's not Hillary. And they know that if he goes down, the Republican Party goes down, the Democrats are in charge, and they get to appoint Supreme Court justices and all that stuff. So they are willing to take all the bad. And believe me, I know, I've tried, and I've given up on it. The Republican Party is completely, completely committed to Donald Trump from top to bottom.
But aren't particularly some of these trade decisions that the presidents have been making, don't they go right at the economic security of some hardcore Trump supporters, Essex?
I have read stories with hardcore Trump supporters who are being hurt by the trade decisions and still saying they support President Trump.
Hmm. Why?
I think Chris has outlined it very well.
Because politics is no longer about trade. It's no longer about taxes, no longer about business. It's about culture. It's about standing for the national anthem. It's about not wanting those people coming to our country.
Let's make it more explicit. It's largely about race.
It's racism. Yes, ma'am. You're a thousand. The Republican Party has become a white nationalist movement to a large degree, and that's what drives everything. It's a bunch of older white voters who are very unhappy with what they see as the country changing around them. It scares them. And that's what matters to them, not trade.
That's the former chair of the Republican State Party in Washington
former.
State.
Former.
Chris Vance, also with us, ex-Essex Porter from Cairo, and Erica C. Barnett. We'll be back in a moment with more of The Week in Review. I'm Ross Reynolds. I'm Ross Reynolds in for Bill Radke. We are looking over the past week with Essex Porter, Chris Vance, and Erica C. Barnett. A gun control or gun safety initiative, if you prefer, got a major infusion of cash this week. Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen and entrepreneur Nick Hanauer each donated $1 million to I-639. In a statement, Paul Allen said, I-639 is a reasonable and necessary measure that will improve safety in our schools and communities, end quote. That's a fair amount of money. What role do you think money is going to play in this gun safety measure and its success or lack of on the ballot? What do you think, Essex?
Well, I think two roles for money. Of course, you know, again, you will need to pay signature gatherers, and so a lot of the money will be spent there. You will need to market the initiative and advertise for November if it makes the ballot, so a lot of money will be spent there. So much money may frighten away gun rights groups like the NRA so that they will not partake in a strong campaign against this.
Wow, is there any history of the NRA being frightened away by—
Yes.
That's how the current initiatives, the past initiatives actually passed. The NRA mm-hmm. did not participate that mm-hmm. much. And because the initiative is backed by two billionaires who can spend much more than $1 million, if the NRA does decide to fight this, they will have to commit a lot of money, and which may take away from some of their efforts somewhere else. And they may decide that because of Washington's history of passing gun safety initiatives, it is not a good bet.
Interesting. So you think this $1 million might just be the down payment? There could be more money forthcoming should there be a big NRA effort to defeat
ISIS. I think the NRA has to see it as a down payment.
Right. What do you think about the role of money in this
Well, I can't really add anything to that. I think that's absolutely right. But I also think that, you know, if this was a really strong gun safety, and I mean, don't get me wrong, it is an important step for gun safety advocates. But if this was a really strong initiative that took more action than just, you know, changing the minimum age and creating enhanced background checks for some guns and things like that, I think the NRA would be much more active and much more likely to jump in, no matter how much money is being spent. But I mean, these are ultimately, you know, tiny baby steps toward actually addressing the problem of gun violence in Washington, which kills, you know, I want to say more than 700 people a year was the last statistic in Washington state alone.
Yeah, and two things. First of all, whenever you talk about initiatives, you have to talk about money, because there has not been an initiative qualified in this state with volunteer signature gatherers in like 50 years or more. If you want to do an initiative in Washington state, you've got to have the money to hire a signature gathering firm, period, no matter what the issue is. This money's going to get this thing on the ballot. And then Eric is right. I believe, and I don't speak for the NRA, they don't talk to me, but I think their strategy would be if somebody went so far as to propose something that would, like, for instance, ban all rifles or ban semi-automatic rifles.
Then they might jump in.
Or they might just say that's blatantly unconstitutional and just wait to deal with it in court. But something like this that's probably very popular and doesn't make that big a change to gun laws— The NRA has a history of standing aside, knowing they can't win in Washington state in a battle like this.
Is there anything new to debate about these gun control issues? These issues have been debated time and time again. Is there anything new on that? There's a higher body count, yes, from schools, but is there anything else that's fresh to this discussion?
Well, I think the higher body count, as you put it, I mean, it's, you know, it's becoming more and more abundantly clear to, I think, everyone except the NRA base and, you know, maybe the 35% of people who support Donald Trump, that this is a problem that only happens here. It only happens here. And saying, oh, it just can't be avoided, is becoming less and less acceptable. Again, I don't know if that makes a difference, you know, enough of a difference to counteract the NRA's, you know, billions of dollars that, you know, they're going to be able to spend and that they have spent to protect people's right to have assault rifles in their houses. But, you know, I do think that there has been a shift in the last few years. There have been more people killed by guns at schools this year already than in all of 2017.
You know, we did an event called Ask a Gun Owner, and some of the people doing the asking were some of these high school students who'd been part of the protests which took place. And one of their takeaways was, oh, all the gun owners are not part of the NRA agenda at all. And there's a lot of differentiation between them. So the NRA is not necessarily going to be the party.
Every poll shows that. Yeah. The overwhelming majority, I think, of gun owners would support the kind of law we have here in Washington state, which requires true universal background checks, even if you buy from a private party. I think the overwhelming majority of people are in favor of banning bump stocks, which we've done in Washington State, and make, you have to be 21 to buy a rifle. So most people support common sense. There you go.
Well, we'll see. You will probably be approached to sign I-639, and it's likely to be on the ballot with this kind of funding behind it. This is The Week in Review. I'm Ross Reynolds. We're going to be continuing by moving on to the question of politics. Is Jay Inslee preparing a campaign for president? Bill Radke asked him that very question back in February.
Are you running for president?
I've got the best job in the world right now, and I'm doing it, and it is. I mean, our state is...
Not a denial.
I'm running for, I'm a governor, I intend to be governor.
Ah, but for how long? Washington Governor Jay Inslee is on the schedule for the June 23rd Iowa Democratic Party's annual Hall of Fame celebration. Politico calls this the Democrats' first cattle call event of the presidential race. Just 3 years ago, the same event drew top 2016 presidential hopefuls. Hillary Clinton was there, Bernie Sanders was there. Now, Jay Inslee is chairman of the Democratic Governors Association, but should we read any more into this? What do you think, Chris?
Gee, he's doing exactly what people do when they run for president. He got himself positioned as the chairman of the Democratic Governors Association. He's speaking at a major event in Iowa. Yeah, he's running for president, unless something comes along to show me otherwise. He's doing this all the same things that other governors have done, like Bill Clinton and Jimmy Carter. He's making all the steps to run for president.
Why doesn't he just say that? He might run.
It's too soon.
Why?
Well, one thing in politics is as soon as you say it, you don't get the announcement. When you announce, you want to have a crowd and flags and a band and balloons and make it a big deal. If you say it like, just, yeah, I'm running for president, then you lose that. So there's a saying in politics, you don't want to lose your announcement. So you can be quiet until you script and plan the announcement.
I wonder if you could each handicap for me Jay Inslee for president. What advantages might he have? What disadvantages would he have if he were actually to jump forward and do that? Erica?
He's a white male. That's going to be an advantage, sadly, in 2020, because people, you know, believe, and I think rightly, that Hillary Clinton was defeated in no small part because of her gender. If you read her book, she makes a very good case for that. His disadvantages, he's a liberal governor of an obscure state. Sorry, Washington, but we are a blue state, and we're fairly obscure in the national political scene. He has not taken really bold, strong positions on a lot of issues that are, you know, at the center, at the forefront of national politics right now. He's sort of known as the renewable energy governor, which is an important issue, but not a headline marquee issue. Bob Ferguson, the attorney general, has been out front on issues around immigration. You know, Jay Inslee hasn't really been outspoken on women's rights, on the opiate epidemic, on a lot of these issues that are really important to Americans more broadly than, you know, clean cars and renewable power. And, you know, when he's been given an opportunity to kind of speak out on those issues, he really retreats to that, you know, I'm the green governor of a green state. And I don't think that that is going to necessarily be super inspiring on a national stage.
Essex, what do you think when it comes to Jay Inslee's advantages or disadvantages? Does he have a strong record as governor to run on the national stage?
Well, I think, as governors, the first thing governors always say is, I balance the budget. Well, in most states, you know, you have to balance the budget by law, but, you know, the federal government doesn't have to balance the budget. So, you know, he will certainly have that to run on. You know, I would think one of potential weaknesses is, you know, he has always been a strong advocate of gun safety laws. In fact, lost an election as a Congress representative in Eastern Washington because of it. And I think that, you know, I think critics and opponents will bring up that record as a way to make people in other parts of the country uncomfortable with him. But, you know, his environmental record and the things he's been pushing there for a long time will definitely help. It does unfortunately hurt to be, as Erica noted, in Washington State, which can be obscure and mysterious to the punditocracy class that you know, everybody has to run through as they're vetted for president.
We're not the heartland.
It's just the upper left-hand corner.
No, see, I completely disagree with that. Washington is one of the most interesting, vibrant, dynamic states in America. Seattle is cool. People around the country think Seattle's a big success story. The rest of us all want to drive Amazon away, but I mean, this is the home of Microsoft and Amazon and Boeing and Starbucks. And being from Washington, I think, could be a huge benefit for him. And we're all so close to Jay Inslee. I mean, I've known him forever. I served in the legislature with him, that you get jaded in terms of the reality. But look, this is a guy who's been governor for 8 years over a state with a booming economy. They've accomplished a lot. They've poured billions into education. He's got a strong record on the environment. There's been no scandal, no problems like that. He's a good-looking, good candidate, smart guy. I don't know why people think he can't be a very serious candidate in the second tier, at least to begin. And you know, Mike Dukakis talked about the Massachusetts miracle. Jay Inslee can talk about the Washington miracle. Mm-hmm. While the rest of the state's having problems, our economy's booming. And by the way, there's a lot of money in Seattle. And if he can tap into that, he could be a formidable candidate.
Find me one person who thinks Jay Inslee is like the most dynamic, exciting, you know, speaker, governor, anything.
He's won a bunch of elections, period.
I want to move on to the other political news this week. A Republican State Party Chair, Susan Hutchison, announced she's running against Maria Cantwell for the U.S. Senate. Chris, by virtue of her profile, is she the front runner in the GOP nomination for Senate?
Well, yeah, but that's a really low bar. There are a whole bunch of people, you know, just cranks and weird. No, sorry, Erica. Stranger people, you know, not really credible candidates filed. Of course, Susan becomes the front runner, but there is no chance she's going to win this election. It's almost impossible for a Republican to win statewide now, and it's definitely impossible in an off-year election when Donald Trump is defining the Republican Party, and she's been a total apologist for the president.
And as someone who ran statewide, you can testify to that fact.
Yeah, and
as a Republican,
and people forget what the polls and everything looked like pre-Trump. When I got in the U.S. Senate race, Patty Murray's approval ratings were very low. Barack Obama's approval ratings were very low. Republicans thought we could be competitive. Trump changed everything. He's popular in some parts of America, but he's crippling to Republicans here.
And Susan Hutchison has never disavowed President Trump. And in fact, I think she's embraced him as the Republican Party chair.
She has embraced him.
Is that going to help her get the nomination, or is that even going to be a factor there? What do you think, Essex?
Well, I think it actually helps her because you only have to be in the top two. You assume Maria Cantwell, with her head start and her money, will be number one. So I think Susan Hutchison, who also has a bit more of a profile people will recognize, and certainly can count on the Trump base, can take her to number two.
Erica, what do you think? Does anything work to her advantage if Susan Hutchison is the final candidate running against Maria Cantwell?
Does anything work to Susan Hutchison's advantage?
Yes.
Well, I mean, in kind of doing some research about this, I looked back on some of Susan Hutchison's greatest hits, which I think sort of put her squarely out of, out of sync with the majority of people in Washington State.
Oh, give us the top three.
Let's see. She said that Trump's comments about grabbing women's genitals were made when he was a Democrat, so that was okay.
Number two.
She sued for reverse racism at Cairo when she lost her job to an Asian American woman.
And the number one thing she said that you think
well, I'm not ranking these, but actually this might be number one. She was a strong defender of Trump's Muslim ban at the time. And that Muslim ban was obviously ruled unconstitutional. He's still fighting for it. And will she double down on that when she's the nominee? We'll see.
Oh. We shall see. Erica, Essex, and Chris are with me. We're going to take a short break and be back with our final story of the week. It's a scary one. This is The Week in Review. Do you have a smart speaker in your living room? Well, imagine this. You're sitting around talking to your wife, your husband, your kids, and there's a pause, and all of a sudden the phone rings, and it's a friend, and the friend says they just received an audio recording of your conversation. Well, Cairo TV talked with a Portland woman who says audio from a private conversation with her husband was sent to a random person in her contacts.
The person on the other line said, "Unplug your Alexa devices right now." We go around and unplug them all. He proceeded to tell us that he had received audio files, recordings from what was going on in our house. At first, my husband was like, "No, you didn't." And he's like, "You're sat there talking about hardwood floors." And we're, "Oh gosh, you really did."
The co-director of UW's Tech Policy Lab, Ryan Kahlo, told AP it's rare, but it is going to happen.
As Amazon characterized this, I tend to agree, it is a low probability event. But I think it's the kind of thing that is inevitable when you introduce connected microphones into a home environment and you have a complex interface.
In fact, Kalo says connected electronic devices are going to change how we think about being alone or whether you ever are alone.
It only reinforces people's fears and concerns that when they're in their home and there are connected devices, that they're not truly alone. You know, I think one of the big problems with this technology is that it has the possibility of compromising feelings of solitude.
Essex, one of your colleagues, worked on this story. And do stories like this kind of reduce the possibility of these devices getting stronger acceptance?
Yeah, I don't know. It's my colleague Gary Horker at Cairo 7 who broke this story, and now it's worldwide. It does make people nervous, but I don't know if people will back off buying the devices because they do add so much convenience. One of the things that Gary pointed out to me is a very different way of treating this sort of thing that happened when Starbucks had a manager in Philadelphia. Had black customers arrested because they were just sitting quietly waiting for a friend. The CEO of Starbucks went and personally apologized to them and began a program to deal with that sort of thing and to help people in Philadelphia and help their employees nationwide. But Amazon has been very standoffish with this family. They had to be cajoled by the family into finally responding. There was a very limited statement to the news media at first, and now a somewhat expanded one. But Gary tells me nobody at the high levels of Microsoft has gone to apologize the way Starbucks did when it had a troublesome incident happen.
Erica?
I mean, I would question how much convenience these things add to our lives. I don't have one, and I disable the microphone on my computer. I cover up my camera. I mean, I have a sense of as much solitude as I can in a city where there are people, you know, who can see in my windows because I live in an apartment.
Let me second that. I think I'm the only one of us who has an Alexa, and what I use it for is to say, play KUOW. What convenience is that for me? I don't have to walk over and push a button. Not a very big convenience versus the fear of my latest conversation with my wife going out to my friends, a random friend. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for being with us today. We really appreciate it. You've been listening to The Week in Review with Cairo TV's Essex Porter, former state GOP chair Chris Vance, and Erica C. Barnett. Check her out at C is for Crank. Bill Radke's back on Tuesday, and in fact, he's going to be talking about that day-long anti-racial bias training all Starbucks employees are going to be having. Have a superb Memorial Day weekend. I'm Ross Reynolds. Good afternoon.